This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Well, one of the questions that launched me on the journey in the first place was, what am I going to say to my grandchildren who aren't born yet when they ask me, what did you do back in 2008 when you really knew what was starting to unfold in terms of climate change? What did you do?
Whether staying within a 60-mile radius of his home or crossing the globe on nothing but the power of her two oars, today's guests on Sea Change Radio both demonstrate their commitment to being good ancestors. Kurt Holting, the author of The Circumference of Home, spent a year adventuring around his home without a car, something that all of us could do, but most of us don't. While the achievements of Roz Savage, the first woman to row across the Pacific Ocean on her own, are unfathomable to most of us. But Kurt Holting and Roz Savage share a common goal, spreading a message of environmental stewardship. Today on Sea Change Radio, raising awareness through ordinary and extraordinary feats. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Roz Savage. Roz is a British ocean rower. She's the first woman to row solo across the Pacific, and she's rowed across the Atlantic Ocean as well. She's embarked on these voyages in order to raise awareness about climate change and plastic pollution. Roz, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
And what was the inspiration? Was there one particular moment when you saw some degradation to land or saw plastic pollution that kind of said, what can I do to make a difference? Or tell us how this came about.
The way that I had my awakening as an environmentalist came hot on the heels of my awakening as an individual, I suppose. For 11 years, I'd worked as a management consultant in London, until I got to my mid-30s and had a bit of an early midlife crisis, realised that if I carried on living my life as I was then, I just wasn't going to end up with the kind of life I really wanted to live. I wanted to get out there and do something more interesting and meaningful instead. And it was around that time of getting more clarity about my own objectives in life, where I was going through this process of kind of joining up the dots of my days and looking to see if they were actually taking me in the right direction, that I stumbled across some writings about the Hopi tribe of North America and their very sensible belief that we have to look after the earth if we want it to look after us. And so I realised that kind of in parallel with my own joining up the dots exercise, when I joined up the dots of where we were heading collectively as the human race, that looking into the future, we probably weren't going to end up with the kind of future that we would really want to have, that we weren't going to end up with a clean, healthy, beautiful world. And I was very alarmed by that prospect. I was also faintly appalled that as a supposedly well-educated, well-informed professional, I had been so oblivious to this that I just hadn't even really thought about the way that we're treating our only planet and what the likely long-term consequences of that would be. And I felt like if I'd been so oblivious to this, maybe lots of other people were oblivious too. And maybe there was something that I could do to help spread this awareness and just get people to think about where we're heading. And is that really where we want to go for our long-term future?
And what exactly have you done? Tell us a little bit about some of these spectacular rowing feats.
Well, the Atlantic was my first ocean in 2005. The reason that I decided to get into ocean rowing was because I had this environmental message that I wanted to share, but there was no particular reason why anybody would want to listen to a recovering management consultant. So I felt like I needed a platform, some way of getting people's attention to get this message out there. And the fact that I'd rowed in college many years ago gave me the happy delusion that rowing across oceans was something I might be vaguely qualified to do. And it's a pretty unusual thing. There's only about 300 people in the world have rowed across an ocean, of whom only about 10% have done it solo. And so it seemed like this would be sufficiently unusual and attention-getting to get the message out there. So the Atlantic in 2005 actually ended up being not so much about the environmental message, but about just sheer survival. It was a terrible year for weather in the North Atlantic, officially the worst year since records began. And it was also my first ever ocean, so I was on a horrendously steep learning curve. And I spent 3.5 months out there, mostly rolling around on 20-foot waves, wondering what the hell had possessed me to do this crazy thing. So the Atlantic was my personal inner journey, and the Pacific has become the outer journey to take what I learned on the Atlantic and apply it to these big environmental issues.
So what will this Indian Ocean crossing that you're planning on for March 2011 entail? Are you leaving from... Where are you leaving from? Where are you heading to?
From Fremantle in Western Australia to, to be determined, really. I might aim for Zanzibar, but at the moment I'm thinking it might actually be more interesting if it is meteorologically feasible to aim for somewhere like Dubai, because that is such a very consumerist society, whereas Africa has a pretty minuscule carbon footprint relative to those very affluent countries of the Middle East. So if I really want to bring the message to a relevant audience, then I think it would be considerably more impactful to actually go to the heart of the beast.
Right. And they're also going to have local media coverage there where people can
be
touched by your story, hopefully.
Which is important. I found it quite frustrating, actually, over the last 3 years during my 3-stage row across the Pacific. Obviously, landing in Hawaii was fine. They've got fantastic infrastructure and media there. But then the following year, I landed in Kiribati, which is a very small country, pretty much in the back of beyond. It's fairly obscure. And this is one of their problems. They're a bit like the Maldives in that within the next 100 years, they expect that their islands are going to become uninhabitable because of climate change and rising oceans. And their current president, President Anote Tong, is the man with the unenviable task of designing their exit strategy. He's trying to get money from the international community so that they can buy themselves some time to mitigate the impacts of climate change. But ultimately, they're going to have to relocate. And it's very unlikely that they'll find a single country willing to accommodate all 100,000 of them. So they will probably be scattered to the four corners of the earth and will lose their culture. It's pretty sad, but I saw them in Copenhagen last year at the UN Climate Change Conference. And like many of the small island states, they had been fairly comprehensively ignored by the bigger financial hitters there. I was really quite surprised how much Copenhagen was about money rather than about climate. I actually came away from Copenhagen fairly devastated in several ways, and not only by the theft of my backpack. I lost my faith in that particular process to come up with a fair and binding treaty on climate change. And my mission, I think, as I see it, is much more a grassroots kind of message. It seems like our leaders just are not willing to take a stand on this. I don't know if it's because democracy, where you typically have a 4-year election cycle, doesn't encourage that kind of long-term thinking and those tough decisions that we need to make. Maybe that's part of the problem. But I think we as consumers, we need to make our voices heard. We need to say to our leaders, it's not okay to carry on trashing the earth. We don't want an earth that's stricken by drought and climate change refugees, and all these toxins we're putting out there are going to come back and bite us in the forms of cancers and allergies and, autism is on the rise. And this is just not okay. If we are going to have a healthy, happy future, we really need to just realign ourselves now. And I'm very into the accumulation of many tiny actions to make a big difference. When I look at things like the North Pacific garbage patch, That huge quantity of plastic out there didn't get there overnight. That's been the accumulation of 40 or 50 years since plastic went into mass production, of people using plastic for inappropriate purposes and not being careful enough about how they dispose of it. It would be great to get back to the kind of culture that we had even just 60 years ago, where we wouldn't just use something for half an hour and then throw it away. Someone described it to me as the five R's. You might have heard of reduce, reuse, recycle. But they actually said refuse, like say no to plastic in the first place if you can. Reuse, repurpose, repair. And then only as a last resort do you recycle, because even recycling's got its own carbon footprint. I mean, this is what I can do with my rowing, I think. My sort of metaphor for this is that each of my oar strokes only gets me like 2 or 3 feet. But if I take 1 million oar strokes, which is roughly how many it took to get me across the Atlantic Ocean, then it adds up to a really big result. And likewise, if we had 7 billion people getting out of their, let's say, suboptimal habits as consumers, and instead getting into good green habits as consumers, when you add that up day after day and year after year, when you just run the numbers, it makes a really big difference.
Well, what you're doing is admirable and remarkable at the same time, and we appreciate you being with us. Our guest again is Roz Savage. She's a British ocean rower who's the first woman to row solo across the Pacific, and she's also rowed across the Atlantic Ocean. And starting in March 2011, she'll begin rowing across the Indian Ocean. We wish you well with that voyage as well, Roz, and we hope that you feel like Sea Change Radio is a platform where you can come back and continue to get your message out about climate change and plastic consumption and any other environmental issues that you feel are near and dear to your heart. Thanks for being our guest on Sea Change Radio.
Absolutely. Keep up the great work.
Row, row, row my boat, gel it down the stream. Row, row, row my boat, gel it down the stream. Merrily, merrily, life is just a dream.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Kurt Holting. He's a commercial fisherman and wilderness guide from Whidbey Island, Washington, and he's the author of the new book, The Circumference of Home, One Man's Year-Long Quest for a Radically Local Life. Welcome to Sea Change Radio, Kurt.
Nice to be here, Alex.
Tell our listeners a little bit about the idea behind The Circumference of Home and what you set out to do with it.
Right. Yeah, the book grew out of a year that I spent, basically 2008, not getting in a car for the whole year and living within a circle I drew around my home in Puget Sound with the idea of seeing if I could lower my carbon footprint and at the same time fall back in love with the terrain that I grew up in around Puget Sound by exploring under my own power a lot of places that I'd never really been to.
And what did that entail?
So it entailed a number of things. For one thing, I had to basically treat the year as a transitional year, because part of what I was trying to do was develop more local livelihood for myself. At the time, I was traveling quite a bit outside the region, a lot by jet, and the motivation for doing it was my concern when I discovered that my carbon footprint was 2.5 times the national average, in spite of the fact that, you know, I drive a Prius, I really work hard to conserve energy in my personal lifestyle. So discovering what a huge factor jet travel was in my carbon footprint really got my attention, got me thinking about how I might begin to reconfigure my livelihood so that I was working more locally. And at the same time, I kind of took the year as a self-styled sabbatical, because I had to cut out, I took a real hit in income during that year for sure, partly because I wasn't traveling doing the work that I was accustomed to doing, and partly because I took a lot of time to explore under my own power around the Puget Sound Basin within this circle, 60-mile radius circle that I'd drawn around my home. So on foot, by bicycle, and by sea kayak. I work as a wilderness guide in the summer, sea kayak wilderness guide in the summer in Alaska, and I'd never really explored my own home waters that much or my own home terrain on foot, the area close to home, rather than always going out into the mountains or the wilderness when I wanted to do some exploring.
But one of the things that got you thinking about doing this was you were flying from Norway, where your daughter lived or lives, and you were calculating your carbon footprint and realizing that this one flight from Seattle to Norway and back is just completely putting all of your mindful activities
canceling out, all the other efforts I might be making to limit my carbon emissions for the whole rest of the year. So basically, when I travel now, or when the prospect of travel comes up, I just really ask myself some questions. Is this trip really going to enrich my life? Why am I doing this? What am I trading off? You know, what are the possibilities for self-improvement, for self-discovery, for exploration, for adventure that I'm leaving behind by going on this trip? You know, is it really necessary? And sometimes it is. So, you know, sometimes it is necessary. But a lot of the time, it really isn't.
This is something that you did for a personal journey, but you were also trying to make a larger statement, obviously, by writing a book about it. What is that larger statement?
Well, what I discovered in the year, and actually I didn't begin this with the idea of writing a book. It wasn't for that purpose. I really did it out of a sense of really strong desire to make some changes in my own life and to see if I could make the effort itself into an adventure. And it turned out to be such an adventure, such an amazing year on so many levels that I ended up writing this book about it.
Yeah, you didn't exactly stay at home playing video games. This was something that you pushed it to the max of this 60-mile radius, didn't you?
That's right. So a week or more out of each month, basically, I set up a series of adventures for myself. So things like going from home to summit of Mount Baker and back under my own power. Things like paddling 200 miles, 100 miles each way from my home on Whidbey Island to Cowichan Bay on Vancouver Island. Some fantastic bicycle journeys that I took, and a wonderful 130-mile walking circuit that I took through the area closest to my home, through the Skagit Basin and the 50-mile length of Whidbey Island, because I really wanted to experience my home landscape moving through it at about 3 miles per hour, which is the speed that humans moved through the world for thousands of millennia, right up to just the last generation or so.
So that reminds me of the quote from Gary Snyder's in The Practice of the Wild. Snyder describes us all becoming Native Americans. You encountered several curious people along the way who had a lot of questions about what you were doing, and you don't answer all of them. These are questions that are being posed to you in the book. Let me give you some of the questions that these people posed to you, and maybe you can answer them for our listeners now. One man shakes his head and says matter-of-factly, "There is no way I could ever give up a car. No way." I think we're so rooted in the automobile being part of our society that that's become a common thing for people to think and to say. But now people say that with cell phones, and people kind of laugh about it. But in 30, 40 years, it could be pretty comparable.
Right. I think the biggest challenge in facing our addiction to cars is understanding that it actually is a kind of addiction, or it's a mindset. You know, for example, one-third of all the gas that's pumped in this country goes to fuel solo trips by car within 3 miles of home. And the fact of the matter is, for a lot of us anyway, if we're able-bodied, and if we choose, we could make some of those trips without getting into our car. You know, the half mile to the store to buy a quart of milk or whatever it might be. We benefit when we do that. I do. I find that whenever I make that choice to walk or get on my bicycle, I feel better when I get where I'm going. It keeps me healthy. And it actually does make a difference when you add up all of our choices in this way. So my perspective on this and a lot of my motivation for doing, taking on this experiment was that I want to make some of these choices while it's still an option, while there's still some, you know, freedom of choice. And when people tell me there's no way they could ever get by without their car, I just think that maybe that's not true, and that that we can do more of this than we think, and the time may well be coming when there will be enough scale of change due to climate change, rising sea levels, and so forth, that we no longer really have the option of getting in our cars in the same way. Wouldn't it be nice if we could make some of those shifts before our hands are forced to do so? And while there's some, you know, some creative potential in how we direct those changes and some benefits to, you know, to our own lives personally.
Lost all my money but a $2 bill. $2 bill, Lord, a $2 bill. Lost all my money but a $2 bill. I'm on my long journey home. It's dark and raining and I gotta go home. I gotta go home, Lord, I wanna go home. It's dark and raining and I gotta go home. I'm on my long journey home. Lost all my money but a $2 bill.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is the author of The Circumference of Home, Kurt Hulting. Let me give you some other questions that you mentioned in the book, and I was hungry for some answers and curious how you would have answered them. And a woman asked me, do you think you could do this in the middle of raising kids like I am? It made me think that maybe fear and of overprotecting our children from our society has fed into that as well. Because I remember growing up that we were sent out to go do errands a lot more. So use your kids to go. If you don't want to walk to go get that quart of milk, get your kid to walk and do it, not only because it's good for them and exercise, it can help the house. And that was kind of, that's part of the Native Americanism aesthetic that you were talking about.
That's right. And there's a point in my book when I talk about that quite explicitly, about the epidemic of nature deficit disorder, as some people are calling it, especially with children. And I did this with my own kids more than I wish I had. But we tend to pile our kids into the car and take them, you know, take them everywhere, and keep them on a pretty tight leash in terms of how far we let them wander and explore. A lot of that's out of fear. A lot of that's what is projected by the media that generates this kind of fear. But in point of fact, kids need contact with nature every day, and they need to have some freedom to roam and explore.
So you weren't really trying to, with this experiment, you weren't really trying to, you didn't have a predestination
That's
in mind.
Right.
You were just thought it was the right thing to do, and let's see where it goes, which is a nice metaphor for the way I think a lot of people should live their lives a little more.
Yeah. When I've found that I tend to lose hope most when I'm sitting on my duff, when I allow myself to accept this premise that it's not going to make any difference anyway. You know, hope is a word that's bandied about quite a bit, but It actually is an orientation of the spirit, as Havel suggests, that grows out of the way we engage and enter our lives.
This was 2008 that you did this, right?
That's right.
Looking back on it, what have you taken from it?
Yeah, so the changes I made in really cutting down my use of cars, using public transportation, becoming much more literate in what the options are for alternative ways of getting around, and using them, that I really have maintained that practice. And it's not that much of an effort now to do that. You know, I use my bike routinely, and I didn't before. It's my primary mode of transportation, mainly because it's just so much more fun and satisfying to move around that way. So a lot of the benefits of the year have really stayed with me.
Wait, you just had John Perry Barlow on the show last week, and then he talked about how we're really pretty crappy ancestors right now. And Thoreau talks a lot about being a good ancestor. And
well, one of the questions that launched me on the journey in the first place was, what am I gonna say to my grandchildren who aren't born yet when they ask me, what did you do back in 2008 when you really knew what was starting to unfold in terms of climate change? What did you do? So the desire to become a better ancestor myself to my unborn children, grandchildren, was a major motivation for me. We live such horizontally shallow lives, and finding that dimension of deep time. I quote the Zen proverb somewhere in the book, never forget the 1,000-year view. So that was part of what I wanted, to sort of reinvest my daily life experience with a sense of a deeper sense of time, you know, time that includes ancestors and makes room for our unborn children in the choices that we're making right now here today.
And you really made room for a dialogue with both your ancestors and the unborn. And it seems like a lot of people, when they're thinking of the future, they may think of, well, who am I going to marry someday? Or what kind of cars will we be driving someday? But people don't think about the conversations they may be having with these people who they don't know yet. And I think that's an important thing for us all to consider, is what are you going to tell your grandkids someday? What did you do when you knew that there was problems facing us all?
That's a wonderful question to carry in the heart every day.
Kurt Hulding, author of The Circumference of Home, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Ikebe Shakedown, Doc Watson and David Grisman, and Dr. John. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Kuva Coffee Company, Bounty Growing System, Sungevity Solar Home Specialists, and Invisible Structures, a sustainable paving company. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.